Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After listening, be sure to join our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to connect with the community and discuss the episode. Follow us and enable notifications on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform so you don't miss new episodes. You can also find all episodes and information on this subtype or your subtype on SFA's website, curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. In this episode, we sit down with Carol Haslam of Sarcoma Cancer Ireland. Carol not only is a board member and driving force behind the organization's operations, but she is also a synovial sarcoma survivor and passionate patient advocate. As our first international guest, Carol offers a deeply personal look at her diagnosis and treatment journey in Ireland. She reflects on the road to getting her diagnosis and then the practicalities of navigating care, stepping away from her career as a florist after discovering the sarcoma was in her hand, and what it meant to raise two young children while facing cancer, all while maintaining the unmistakable humor you'll hear throughout our conversation. Carol also shares the origin story of Sarcoma Cancer Ireland and illustrates what powerful grassroots advocacy looks like. From helping bring a sarcoma specialist to Ireland to collaboration across the global sarcoma community, she shows how collective voices can drive meaningful change. This episode is rich with storytelling, insight, vulnerability, and yes, plenty of laughter. It's an inspiring and uplifting conversation you won't want to miss. Let's dive in. Welcome to Sarcoma Stories, if this is your first time listening, and welcome back if you're returning. My name is Tasha. I'm one of your hosts.
Hi, and I'm Brandy, your other host.
Today, we are joined by Carol Haslam. We have our very first international guest on Sarcoma Stories, which is so exciting because we are being listened to all over the world. Our podcast has gone international, so it's only appropriate that we have international guests joining us. Carol, thank you so much for being our first international guest and for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me. I feel quite honored I'm your first international guest.
Yes, it's a big title to hold. Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
I am Carol Haslam. I'm 45 from Southern Ireland and I'm a sarcoma patient and I'm also a member of the board of Sarcoma Cancer Ireland.
Yes, and for our listeners who aren't aware, Sarcoma Cancer Ireland is another organization located in Ireland, of course.
That represents patient advocacy organization in Ireland. We'll get into this much deeper later, but Carol, how long ago did Sarcoma Ireland officially start? I know I met you, what was it now, 3 or 4 years ago?
I think it was probably 3 years ago at this stage.
Yeah.
So we started in and around 2020, but we only became an official charity in January of 2024, so last year. But we were laying the groundwork for a couple of years beforehand.
It takes time.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, it does.
It takes time.
Well, so exciting. We're going to get more into that. But Carol, where did your sarcoma story begin?
So in 2017, I was actually in Florida on holidays and I reached behind me in the car to pull a bag because I had small kids at the time. So, you know, you're always giving them things and pulling out the bags when you're on vacation. So pulled a bag and kind of felt a tweak in my hand. It was a little bit sore for a couple of days afterwards. Didn't really think anything of it. And then like a month later, it was Christmas time and I was a florist. So at Christmas, floristry work would be very intricate, small, detailed work. So you're using your hands and your fingers a huge amount to make an arrangement. So it was really sore over the Christmas period, but I kind of put it down to it had been busy. We had a lot on. I was really busy and doing a lot. And it started to swell. In floristry, that wouldn't be hugely unusual because you get thorns in your hands and you get cuts and like your hands are very, very much abused. So didn't really think much of it until in January, So my children have autism and I will be part of an autism community. And there's one girl there, Trish, and her thing is you need to look after yourself. So every January she reminds us all we need to make a doctor's appointment and go to the doctor and tell them all the little things that's bothering you that you wouldn't go to the doctor for on their own. But it's an accumulation. So in the January, I went to the doctors and I was like, so I have this and I have this and this, not major things. And then I went, oh yeah, my hand is swollen. And I showed her my hand and she just looked at me and went, and you left that till last? And I was like, okay. I had had carpal tunnel surgery the previous year on the hand. So like scar tissue formed and I was in seeing a hand therapist to help get rid of the scar tissue. So she referred me back to her and I went to see her in like early mid-February. It was actually after Valentine's Day. So in a florist's world, your life is by seasons. So it was between Valentine's Day and Mother's Day, and which is, her Mother's Day is in March here. So it's like 4 weeks difference. So it was like kind of mid-February and she took a look at my hand and went, I need to go over to the hand clinic, which happened to be on the same day in the same hospital. So she went over, spoke to the hand specialist, and he was like, I'll make an appointment. You know, she'll make an appointment. We'll send one out in the post. So he sent an appointment out in the post, but the hand specialist, the hand therapist, wasn't happy with it and went back and said, no, she needs to be seen sooner. I genuinely, in my wildest dreams, never thought you could get cancer in your hand. I never heard of it. It never entered my brain that that was any, it was never anything serious for me, because it was just like, it's sore, it's swollen, it's achy. Yes, I do depend on it for my job, so I do kind of need to get it sorted, but it wasn't an issue per se. So I eventually went in and I happened to see the consultant rather than one of the junior doctors, and he literally spent about 20 minutes just squeezing my hand and touching it and looking at it. And he's also the guy who had done my carpal tunnel surgery, so I knew him. He's a nice, lovely guy, and we'd be very jolly and chatting away to you and laughing and joking. And so he spent 20 minutes just feeling my hand, and he was saying to me, you know, what do you think this is? And I was like, it's not my job, that's your job. No idea. This is my job. I was like, I was hoping
to you.
Yeah, I was like, I was hoping you were going to tell me what it was.
Right. Well, here's what Google says. So maybe we can look into that. I don't know.
Okay. It wasn't even a thing to the point that I Googled it. Like, that's how not much of a thing this was. It was just swollen and a bit achy. So he was like, okay, so what we're going to do is going to send you for an MRI. But we're going to send you for an MRI in a different hospital. And I was like, yeah, fine. Now, Dublin is quite small, so all the hospitals are like maybe half an hour away from each other. So like going to a different hospital here is not a big thing. It's just like, yeah, grand. Like these hospitals are literally a 6 minute drive from each other. So I was like, yeah, fine. And he said to me, you kind of need it done urgently. And I was like, yeah, okay. And I said to him, will I pay? Because we have a public health system here, so we don't actually pay for any of this. But we also have a private health system. So if something's bothering you, you tend to pay for a private scan, and because it's quicker. So I said to him, all right, grand, will I pay for this? Will I go private for it? Because I kind of want it sorted before Mother's Day. And he was like, no, it'll be quite quick. And I was like, okay, fine. And then he said to me when I was leaving, when you get your appointment for your scan, ring here and make an appointment to come back to me. And I was like, yeah, fine. As I was leaving that hospital, so literally 2, 3, 4 minutes later, the phone rang and it was the other hospital that he had referred me to. And wow. I was thinking to myself, my God, these people are on fire today. You know, yeah. It's like, right. Well, again, never thought that they thought this might be anything serious. I was just thinking, these people are so on fire today. So it was a Wednesday and they said to me, can you come in Friday? And I was like, Friday when? And they were like, this Friday at 1 o'clock. And I was like, okay. Thinking again, my God, this is amazing. So went in, got the scan on Friday, came out, made the appointment on the Wednesday for the follow-up appointment, which was like 6 weeks later. and went in, got the scan. And as I was leaving, the girl who scanned me said, this won't be available in the other hospital until Tuesday. And I said, oh, I have my appointment for 6 weeks. It's fine. And I was like, okay, grand, because they have like a centralized system where they can upload things and send them to different hospitals. So I was like, yeah, yeah, that's fine. I was like, my appointment's in 6 weeks anyway. And on the Tuesday, they rang me and said, can you come in tomorrow into the hand clinic? And I, again, I'm thinking, these people are amazing.
They're so good at their job.
So quick. I'm so being looked after. So I was like, yeah, what time do you want me to come in at? And they said to me, can you come in at 9? And I said, well, no, I actually can't because I don't live in Dublin. I'm from Dublin, but I don't live there. So I live on like in County Meath, which is probably half an hour outside of Dublin. And I was like, no, because I have to get the children to school and it's a bit late to try and organize them. And he said to me, just come in anytime you like between 9 and 12:30. And I'm going, oh my God. Okay.
This is amazing. Here.
I was like, these people are fantastic. So I dropped the children to school and went in like at probably 9:15 and was brought straight into the consultant. And that's when I kind of started thinking, okay, something's going on, because he sat me down and he went, hello, Mrs. Haslam, take a seat. Normally he'd be like, hey, Carol, how are you? You know, la, la, la. And then he had this big serious face on and I was looking going, okay. I was on my own because, again, didn't think anything of it, just off I go. And he was like, can you take a seat there? And I was like, yeah, yeah. And he said to me, okay, so your scan results are in. And so the next step is biopsy. And I was like, my head nearly snapped off my neck. And I was like, why are you giving me a biopsy? And he went, well, and I went, oh my God, do you think I have cancer? Again, I'm quite blunt and I'm quite to the point. And he looked at me and went, well, it might not be. Hmm. And I went, oh my God. You know, in your head, you're having these conversations. And I was like, oh my God, he thinks I have cancer. How do you get cancer in your hand? Is that a thing? You know, because I'd only ever heard of like breast cancer or bowel cancer or cancers of a place, not random cancers. And I was like, oh my, and I just asked him again, I was like, do you think I have cancer? And he just went, well, maybe it's not, but we're just checking to be sure. And I was like, okay. But I, from then I knew, like literally I left the hospital and I rang my husband and I was like, oh my God, they think I have cancer. And he was like, don't be ridiculous. Who gets cancer in their hand? And I was like, I don't know. But he thinks I have cancer. And he was like, no, you're just jumping ahead of yourself here. And I was like, no, he was very different than he would normally be with me. He was really serious. You know, I was like, he genuinely thinks I have cancer. So of course, then I'm going, what's happening now? Couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks later, I had went for the biopsy in the hospital that I was scanned the MRI, because it's an orthopedic specialist hospital. So met a different doctor there and got scanned then. Got the biopsy, a guided biopsy under ultrasound. And they said to me, it's a 10-day wait. Longest 10 days of my life.
Yeah.
It was literally, and it, there was an amazing nurse who worked in the hospital and she retired and has since unfortunately passed away, but the woman was literally worth her weight in gold. I stalked her. I literally stalked her. And I'm surprised she didn't hang up on me when she saw my phone number coming up, because she just kept going, still not here, still not here. And I was like, okay. So my son has a thing called optic nerve atrophy. So he was 8 at the time and he was going blind. So we were doing trips all over the world to show him all the things that he wanted to see before he couldn't see them anymore. And we were due to go away on the 6th of April. And the biopsy was done 11 days before the 6th of April. So I was like, I cannot go on holidays. I was like, if this goes over the 10 days, I cannot go on holidays not knowing, because I will go nuts. So we were doing a big trip to, we're actually again going to the States. So we were going to do like San Francisco and Los Angeles, and we went to Vegas and the Grand Canyon and had a brilliant time.
Oh, you hit the whole West Coast.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant fun. We did a road trip down. So I had said to the nurse, you need to ring me with these results, because she's like, we'll make an appointment for when you come back. And I was like, no, you need to tell me. And she said to me, but if I tell you there's something, it won't be in person. I was like, I don't care. I need to know, because otherwise I will go absolutely bananas. So the day before we went, I was at home. It was 7:30 in the morning, and I was getting the children ready for school, as you do. And she rang me and she's like, okay, unfortunately, it's a malignant tumor. I'll make an appointment for us next week. And I was like, I'm supposed to be going away tomorrow. Will I cancel? And she said to me, no, go make memories with your children. And I went,
Oh wow. Yeah,
a little bit. I was like, don't never say that. It's not nice. I was just like, oh my God. And she was like, no, she's like, nothing's going to happen over the next 2 weeks. Anyway, go have your trip and I'll make the appointment for when you come back. And I was like, okay, grand. And she was like, do you understand what I'm saying to you? And I was like, yeah, I do. Yeah. And she's like, do you understand I'm saying you have cancer? And I was like, absolutely. And she said to me, are you okay? And I was like, I'm here with the children, getting them ready for school. So yeah, I'm fine. Obviously, I'm not going to say something in front of an 8-year-old, 10-year-old. So it was like, yeah, no, that's fine. So brought the children to school, sat in the car, rang my husband, rang my sisters, rang my mother. And then we had a meeting in my mother's house, because she would be the midpoint. So everybody just converged. And my husband said to me, because he works on the other side of Dublin, so it's about an hour away. He's like, I'll meet you in your mom's a half in an hour. And I was like, why? And he said to me, you have cancer, love. I'm coming home. And I was like, I have things to do. I'm going on holidays tomorrow. I need to go shopping. I have some things to buy. And he just looked and went, no, I'll be home and I'll go shopping with you. And I was like, oh, fine. But you know, you just kind of go on this like autopilot where you're just doing your thing. But in fairness, I did have things that I needed to get before I went on holidays. So that was how I was diagnosed, really.
Wow. Well, it's good that you had great service where you were.
Amazing.
To make those things move very quickly. Because we hear, and I know you hear, a lot of different stories where it doesn't happen that
Yes.
way. So when you got back from vacation and you had your appointment, what did they tell you were your options?
At what point did they know it was a sarcoma? Because they're telling you you have cancer. And did they at this point did not know it was a sarcoma?
They did. They just didn't tell me because she knew I was going to Google that. So she didn't tell me while I was going on holidays.
But they said you have a malignant tumor. They did not tell you what kind.
Yes, pretty much. Okay. Because she knew as soon as she got off the phone to me that I was onto Dr. Google there. So
yes.
I think she did it for my sake. And like she said to me, you're probably just looking at a bit of radiation and removal, because I am the type of person, I like to know all the information.
Yeah.
Good, bad, or indifferent, and I will process that and then I'll deal with it. Whereas I don't like having questions, no more than most people do. But if they can't answer my questions, I'll find somewhere that can. Mm-hmm. So she knew I was going onto Google and I was checking that out if she told me what that was. She had just said probably a bit of radiation and then a little bit of, you know, removal surgery. So we went away for the 2 weeks and I was saying to Kev, my husband, what am I going to do if I lose function in my hand? Because it was in the palm of my hand. Mm. So it was kind of in between my second and third finger, but in the palm of my hand. And he was like, look, you'll have to deal with that as we go, love. If you lose function, you lose function. There's nothing you can do. And I was like, how am I supposed to work? You know, I work with my hands. This is what I do. This is my livelihood. I own a flower shop. How's that going to work? So you're having all these thoughts in your head and going along. And when we were home on the Saturday, she made an appointment for me for the Wednesday. So it was like 7:00 in the morning. And so we were after coming from America where it's warm to Ireland where it's not in April. And Kev had about 7 layers of clothes on him because it was 7:00 in the morning, the appointment. So he had like t-shirt, jumper, body warmer, coat, hoodie, like the whole shebang, right? And we were sitting there and I walked in and the surgeon said to me, okay, can you give me your hand? So I gave him my hand and he was holding my wrist and he said to me, okay, now make a fist, you know, like you do when you're giving blood. And I was like, okay. And he said, okay, so the good news is I might only have to partially amputate your hand. And I was like, what? Like, he must have thought I was absolutely ridiculous because I just kept going, what? Okay. What? Okay. What? And so I was sitting looking at the doctor and Kev was sitting on my left-hand side. And with that, I just seen him stripping. So there's all these layers. Like, all these layers are coming off. And the nurse turned around to him and she said to him, are you going to pass out? And he went, I might.
Like, I'm the patient now. And
she laughed and she was like, well, I go get you a glass of water. And she said to him, put your head between your knees. So I'm looking at him, absolutely ignoring the fact that he's possibly going to pass out. He didn't in the end, right? But she went and got him a glass of water and I was just looking at the doctor and I was going, okay, what does that mean? And then he said to me, and you're getting chemotherapy. And I was like, oh, what? So I was expecting a little bit of radiation and a little operation. And then this all of a sudden turned into a major operation and chemotherapy for like 4 rounds and like inpatient chemotherapy for like 4 to 5 days at a time. You know the way they say go prepared and ask your questions? I had no questions. I was absolutely not prepared. I was sitting there crying. And one of the first questions I asked, not how am I going to cope with no hand, was like, am I going to go bald? And he went, yes.
That was my first question too. Yeah.
So like, I love my hair. I have like waist length hair and always mm-hmm. have had. And it's definitely, that's definitely part of who I am. Do you know what I mean? And that was one of the first things I said to him. That I just, okay. And started crying again. And it was just a weird, weird morning. And he was like, okay. So, and I just kept looking at the nurse and I was like, are we finished now? And she went, yes. So we left and she followed us out and she said to me, I know you have 400 questions that you haven't thought of. I'll ring you at 11 o'clock and you can go through them all with me. And I was like, thank you. So when I had calmed down at that stage and when she rang me, I did have 400 questions for her and she went through them all and answered everything. So she's amazing, an amazing woman.
I mean, that's a lot to process, especially when you're walking in thinking a little radiation, a little bit of a surgery to go straight from like 0 to 1,000 there.
Yes.
Not even like, I know this is what you're expecting, but this is what we're going to get. You know, this is, here's your options. There was no, here's your options. It was like,
there wasn't really options though, in fairness, because of where it was in my hand, okay. There was absolutely no way he'd get clear margins without at least partial amputation. So there wasn't options. And how do you break that gently to somebody?
Yeah.
There isn't a way to do it. You can't sugarcoat that you're going to lose part of your hand or part of your leg. There's just no way. So it did literally go from 0 to 1,000 in like 3 seconds flat. So it was, you know, I'm just sitting there going, okay, okay. That is literally, and he knows me now, so he's used to me now. But at the time, I'd say he was probably thinking, oh my God, what is with her? Because literally I was going, what? Okay. What? Okay.
Yeah. You were taking that time to process.
I'm not even sure I was processing, to be honest. Right. I think it was just going over my head at that stage because I was just in shock.
I think that's a good point, though. And your nurse then saying, I'm going to call you in a few hours to revisit this with you, because I think that is a part of patient care that, when you are talking about these things, it's impossible to process it all in that moment. And throughout care, it's important to revisit the conversations because absolutely. Questions are going to continue come up and there's no way in the one point you can get everything answered. And so for a medical professional to revisit that with you and say, hey, you are going to have more questions, I think that's a really good standard.
It was amazing. Because she did know that I would have questions and she knew I was blindsided. She knew I wasn't functioning as I normally would. And like when she rang me a couple of hours later, I was much calmer. I'd sat and I talked it through and I was like, okay. And at that stage is when he said to me, you have, what's called a sarcoma, you have synovial sarcoma, it's blah, blah, blah. And he had gone through that kind of stuff with me. So then I kind of knew what I was dealing with. Now, in the meantime, I kind of did think I had a sarcoma because when I got the biopsy done, I obviously read my chart when he gave me my chart.
Of course.
And yeah, I was actually in the bathroom reading my chart and Kessa told me, what are you doing? And I was like, nothing. I'm doing nothing. Yeah. Yeah. So I had read my chart and it was like sarcoma question mark. So then I started Googling what's a sarcoma and I was like, strange. Yeah.
Wow. How quickly did you have to go through from that point sitting in the office to, okay, now I'm in surgery for the amputation? And did you do chemotherapy first?
I did chemotherapy first. So they did chemotherapy with the hopes that they would shrink it, that he would be able to salvage some of my hand. So I have, apparently I had two blood supplies in my wrist. Some people have one, some people have two. So if it shrank enough, he would have been able to salvage my baby finger and the one beside it, but none of the palm except what was underneath there. So I was like,
Right.
So I met with him on the 24th of April and I had chemotherapy then afterwards to go for surgery. And I actually ended up having surgery the 30th of August. So the end of the month. So it was a very quick roller coaster for me. It was like boom, 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 done, you know. So while I had chemotherapy, my tumor nearly doubled in size. It went from 3.8 centimeters to 7.4, I want to say. So originally my hand just looked like it was swollen. It didn't actually look, you couldn't see a tumor. But by the time I was finished chemotherapy, you could actually see a tumor. You could see a big lump. Mm-hmm. And I had said to one of the nurses in the hospital, I was like, this is grown. And she said to me, it's not grown. And I was like, it is grown. And she said to me, how do you know? I was like, because it's pushing my thumb further away from my hand. So it was like, I couldn't actually put my thumb up to my hand. Mm-hmm. Because it was too swollen, like the tumor was grown. So you could kind of gauge it by how far away from the palm of my hand my thumb was. So I was supposed to have four rounds of chemotherapy and me and the nurse had this discussion. And then she said to me, okay, well, we'll get you scanned now rather than after round four, see what we're doing. And then she just said to me, there's no point in you coming back for round four. It's grown. It's not doing anything, whatever. So I was like, right, fine. Then they scheduled surgery for the end of August after I kind of had healed a little bit from the chemotherapy.
There's so much adjustment happening and it sounds like you said a very quick roller coaster, boom, boom, boom. This is one thing after the other. How did you adjust to this, I guess, new reality of your identity? I mean, you're a florist who's now dealing with your hand being amputated. You lost your hair, which you mentioned is a part of your identity. How did you process all of that?
I would be very, you deal with what's happening. I don't push anything off. I don't hide it. Like I am very, it comes at you and you just deal with it. It was strange. So I ended up actually selling the shop because you can't really do much one-handed, to be honest. So in between the end of chemotherapy and surgery, I had met with my surgeon and I woke up one morning and said to Kev, I've been thinking. And when I say that, he cringes because he knows there's something coming. And usually it means work for him, but it wasn't. So he was like, okay, what have you been thinking? And I was like, I'm actually not getting only part of my hand off. I'm getting it all off. And he just went, what? And I was like, I'm going to get them to take it all off because I don't like the whole, there mightn't be clear margins in it. It increases the risk of recurrence in the same spot. I was like, I'm never doing this again. I was like, so I decided rather than just have two fingers, I was like, because what can you do with that anyway? Because you have no grip because you have no thumb. I was like, I'm getting it all off. And Kev just went, are you sure? And I was like, definitely. And he said to me, have you thought about this? And I was like, obviously I've thought about it or I wouldn't have told you, you know.
I've been thinking.
I was thinking, I just said. And like, there, for me, it, there was something like a 1 in 2 chance of it coming back locally. And I was like, nah, that's not happening. Yeah. Yeah. So then I went in to see the surgeon and I said to him, I've been thinking. And he was like, okay. I was like, I'm getting the whole lot off rather than partial amputation. And he just looked at me and went, what? And I was like, that's what we're going to do. And he said to me, okay. He's like, have you thought about this? Do you know? And I was like, I'm not doing this. The chances of recurrence is far too much. Blah, blah, blah. Again, the amazing nurse was there. And she said to me, have you checked all of this out? And I was like, what's this going to do? What are these two fingers going to do for me? I was like, no, no. I was like, my children are too small for me to risk a 1 in 2 chance of it coming back. I was like, so take the lot. We've got good clear margins and then we're good to go. And he just looked and went, are you absolutely sure about this? And I was like, absolutely sure. And he went, it's an easier surgery for me, so I'm okay with that.
Win-win.
Yeah. Now, obviously we talked it through and he asked me if I got questions, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, I'm done. This is what's happening.
Yeah. Well, it's life-changing. You lost your business. I think it's interesting the transition that you have made in terms of Sarcoma Ireland and putting that energy and your experience with sarcoma to building something in Ireland that didn't exist. So can you talk about how did that come about, that the group got together and said, we've got to do something?
So when I was having chemotherapy, I was on a couple of Facebook groups and I got a messenger message one day off a girl and she was like, hi, my name is Catherine. I live in Northern Ireland. She's also a synovial sarcoma patient. She was roughly my age. So she was like, I just wanted to say hi and see how you're getting on. And she was saying she's doing chemo as well. And so we were literally going through the same thing at the same time. Hers was in her leg and thankfully she didn't need amputation. But we both had young children at the time. Now hers were really young, like one was a year old. And so we got chatting there and she said to me, did you know there's a WhatsApp group in Southern Ireland? And I was like, no, can't find anything in Ireland. And she said to me, do you want me to add you in? And I was like, yes, please. So she added me in and our WhatsApp group is actually called the Mad Hatters. It says a lot. It's true to its name, in fairness. And I ended up chatting. There was a girl called Kelly. I will go into Kelly's story in a minute because she is the one who brought us a sarcoma specialist to Ireland. So I got chatting to Kelly and she was really good. Her husband is the patient and we were all, it's just a group of people who were all going through kind of similar stuff and chatting away. And then kind of got a bit bigger and then a kind of like we were going, we really need something here in Ireland. There's no support. There's no anything. Nobody understands what it is. I went into one of the cancer information centers in one of the main hospitals in Ireland and I asked if they have any information on sarcoma and they told me no. Was I sure that was cancer? And I was like, okay. And I was like, I'm pretty sure because this is my chemo drip. Do you know what I mean? I was like,
99.9%.
I would be hopeful that they weren't lying to me and just giving me chemo for the crack.
Right.
It's like, yeah, no. Sorry, crack means fun in Irish, by the way. Different meanings in Ireland and America.
Oh, right. Oh my God.
Yeah. So I was like, it's very lonely and like nobody I knew had ever heard of it, like literally nobody. And when we did eventually get together, we were like, we really should do something. And we were kind of on and off for a couple of years. And then COVID hit in 2020 and Kelly put a message into the Mad Hatters and said, so if anyone is interested in actually starting a charity, please volunteer. Please let me know. So we formed a different WhatsApp group. And that's where we came from, basically. Wow. Yeah.
The story of WhatsApp, just a group of people on WhatsApp saying, you know, we need to come together to do something, to create change. You mentioned that you had young children at the time. What did you tell your young children about what you were going through, and how did you bring them into the process?
So I told them the truth. I had asked my surgeon, am I going to die? And he said to me, you might. And I was like, okay. And he said to me, we're hoping not. We're hoping treatment will be enough. He's like, but you have a very aggressive cancer and you might. And I was like, okay. So my children were 8 and 10 at the time. And so when we were on holidays, my mother was with us because it was her lifelong dream to go to San Francisco. So we brought her for her 60th birthday. And her and Kev were very touchy. It was like a little bit snappy at each other. And I was laughing because I was okay. And they were obviously, you know, it's your child. Even though I was a grown up child, I'm still her child. I'm the baby in my house. So I'm spoiled rotten by all of them still. And, you know, Kev's wife. So they were a bit like... And it's very different being a patient than being somebody on the other side, than being a family member, I have to say. So my mom's just been diagnosed with a blood cancer. And being somebody who, as a patient, you can do things about it. And you go, right, well, I'm going to have my treatment. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I was much more okay as a patient than I am now. So for now, I see the other side where they were coming from. I can understand why they were a bit snappy. Whereas I was like, why are you two moaning? It's me, you know. Right. So my daughter said to me, she was 10, and she said to me when we were away, are you sick? And I said, no, darling, I'm not sick. And she said to me, there's something wrong though, isn't there? And I said, yeah, because I didn't want to tell them on their holidays and ruin it, like, you know. And I was like, yes. And she said to me, what's wrong? And I said, I, you know, you're going, what do I say to a 10-year-old? And I was like, and she said to me, do you have cancer? And I was like, yes, I do. You are a very perceptive child. And she was like, okay, so what is it? And Niamh would be very like me, and she will go and Google that, and she wants to know all the information. So I told her, but I was like, if you Google it, there's studies from like 50 years ago, Niamh. So it's not the correct information. I was like, it's not up to date. It's not the information that you actually need. I was like, you need to talk. We need to talk to our doctors when I go home. So then I told Daniel, and he just looked at me and went, okay. And he was like, are you going to die? And I said, no, I hope I'm not. I was like, there is a small chance I might. I was like, but I do hope I'm not going to. The doctor thinks I'm probably not going to, but I might. You know, there is that chance that I might die. I was like, but it's very small and probably not. So, right. And then I was giving them information. Obviously, I was quite sick. And when you're having chemotherapy, like one of the days I was driving them to school, and I was only after having like a dose of doxorubicin, so I was very sick, and it was their last day of school. I would have kept them off, except it was their last day, so it's the fun day, and they do all the party, and they have the pizza party, and I had gotten home from hospital the day beforehand, and I was like, okay, I forced myself to get out of bed and forced myself up the road, and said to Daniel on the way, bring that sick bucket. So I was driving up the road being sick into the bucket that he's holding for me while I'm driving. Wow. And then I went to my mom's house because her house was right beside the school, slept for the whole time that they were in school, woke up 15 minutes before they were due. And I have two sisters, and my niece was driving my car, and she said to me, why didn't you just ring? And I was like, because I just didn't think of it. They were like, we would have gotten them for you. We would have brought them to school. We'd have brought them home. And I was like, I know, but you just kind of also need to go about your day.
I want to be a human. Yeah. I want to be a person.
I want to bring them to the last day at school, because that's the fun day that they like going to school on, you know.
I want to be mom still.
Yeah. You know, you were very honest with them. That sort of prepares them in case something doesn't go well.
Yes.
They're prepared for it. You know, and I find sometimes that the medical professionals are very hesitant to give that information. I remember sitting there when my mom was diagnosed. And what's interesting, when we were talking earlier about not even really understanding what you're hearing, because I remember it was like our first appointment and they were already talking about palliative care. And I'm sitting here thinking, what does all this mean? I do remember that day they said, you need to go downstairs right now and meet with this other doctor. And I remember they took us in a back room and showed us her PET scan. And I know everywhere around the world doesn't have access to PET scans, but she had her PET scan and it literally lit up everywhere, which meant it was all over
everywhere.
Her body. I mean, it had spread everywhere. And the doctors right then didn't waste any time. And they said, look, we can try this, this, and this. But the longest I've ever seen anyone live with this is 1 year, and that's really stretching it. I imagine you only have 3 to 6 months left. What? And we did not defy the odds. It was like 3 months maybe later that she passed away. So it was very quick. But all that to say, I did appreciate that they were very honest with us in that moment. So we were all better prepared. Not that you can be prepared, but we were at least better prepared. Sometimes you wonder, are kids at 8 and 10 old enough for that? But also, is it also, if it didn't go well, were you setting them up for being more prepared?
If it hadn't have went well and I'd have lied to my children to protect them, my daughter would never have forgiven me. So I think it also depends on the child. Like realistically, I probably could have lied to Daniel to protect him. But if I'd have done that to her and I'd have died, she'd have never, I don't know, I wouldn't be here, but she would have resented her dad for that. So she would have resented the fact that we didn't tell her and she wasn't prepared. And like, in fairness, she was amazing when I was sick. Like, we came home that particular day, the day of coming home from the last day of school, and Kev was due in like 2 hours later. And I said to Niamh, I need to go to bed. I need to lie down. I really don't feel well. And she went, don't worry, ma'am. I'll make Daniel something to eat and I'll look after him. And I'll call you if anything happens, but my dad will be home soon. So like, even at 10, she was really helpful. And now they were pottering around. The TV was on, like, you know, I was two rooms down. I live in a bungalow, so I wasn't even upstairs. You know, it's, you're all on one level. But she did look after him because she knew I wasn't feeling well. And she was old enough to do that. And she was old enough to know what was going on. But if, like, how can you hide that? How can you hide thrown up into a bucket as you're driving to school? You just can't.
Right. It's so perceptive. Yeah.
You know, or you lose your hair. They know I'm not going to shave my head. They know I'm not going bald for no reason, you know. Yeah. So I don't know. I think children are much more resilient than we think they are.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I think you made a good point. Like, it depends on the child. It depends on their age. It depends on the parenting. So, but this was the right choice for your family.
It was definitely for my family. And I'm not saying it would be the same for every family, but I just know if something had happened to me and I didn't make it, she would have resented Kev and it would have ended up much worse for her.
How did your husband interact with you while you were going through all this and helping to make decisions and things? From like the caregiver standpoint.
So Kev is amazing. And anything I needed was, he just did. And I don't need to ask. He's just there. In fairness, he's like that for everything I do in life. He is literally my biggest supporter in the whole wide world. And if I need it, it happens. Magically, you know, as I said, I quite often go to him, I was thinking, and he just look at me and go, oh God. But he just does it for the easy life. Do you know what I mean? So we are very opposite personality wise. So I know he'd be chatty and he'd talk to you and stuff, but I am very outgoing. He is very laid back. Any more laid back and that man would be in a coma. So like, we are literally polar opposites. So I get these brilliant ideas and he just does it because he knows life is just easier if he goes along with what I say. So he was there all the time. And ironically, he works like literally around the corner from the hospital I was treated in. So he used to pop around to me on his lunch break and then he'd come home and he'd get the kids and he'd bring them in to see me. And then he'd come home and feed them, put them to bed. And like, my sisters were minding them in the mornings. So Kev would drop them to my sister's house. She would give them their breakfast and bring them to school when he went into work. Because we still needed to live. I wasn't working, right. So he needed to work. But Daniel walked into my sister's house with his iPad one day and she said to him, I'll have your breakfast on. He said, well, what am I having, Paula? And she said, bacon and pancakes. And he just looked at her and went, can I have the Wi-Fi passcode? And she gave the Wi-Fi passcode and she brought him in his breakfast. My children would never get a cooked breakfast in the mornings. Never, ever before school. That would never happen. So she brought him in his plate of pancakes and bacon and he just looked at her and went, you're the best. And off he went, living his best. He was living his best life.
Yeah. He was probably sad when it was over.
He kind of was, because like Auntie Paula makes breakfast, whereas you get cereal or toast in my house. Do you know what I mean? Right. Not on your life.
Right. So going back to Sarcoma Cancer Ireland, and you joined the WhatsApp group to start this organization. And I know, because I followed your journey, that you guys were successful in getting a sarcoma specialist. But what were the initial discussions of, here are the first things that we need to work on in Ireland? And how did you determine that you needed a sarcoma specialist? What were the priorities originally that you said, okay, we need to start this organization and this is what we need to do?
So this actually predates my diagnosis. So back in 2016, we did have a sarcoma specialist here in Ireland. She was an Italian doctor and she was, again, she wasn't my doctor. I don't know. I'd never met her. Well, I have met her since, but she was apparently the most amazing doctor for sarcoma patients that you could ever have. And her contract wasn't renewed. So again, in Ireland, we have one sarcoma center, one. And you could be, right, we actually have one and a half now. So down in Cork, which is a huge city in Ireland, compared to the cities in America, it's absolutely not huge. But for Ireland, it's a huge city. They have their own MDT, but would also link in with the main MDT in Dublin. And back then, it was just really only Dublin who had, they had started an MDT and they had a medical oncologist for sarcoma. And the Irish Sarcoma Group has gone probably 15 years, but it wasn't centralized and there was no specialist. So we are such a small country. We will get between 250, maybe 300 cases a year. And obviously a good portion of them are children. So children are treated in the main children's hospital in Ireland. No matter where they're from, they go to Dublin for treatment. So they wouldn't be part of the adult MDT. They wouldn't be part of any of the adult MDT discussion because they have their own and they've always had their own. So her contract wasn't renewed and the sarcoma patients were just being given off to, like, depending on where in the body the sarcoma was, they were being given to those oncologists. So some of the patients at the time were like, no, we need a specialist who knows what they're doing, how to treat it. It's treated differently. Like a sarcoma in your breast is treated differently to breast cancer. So This is kind of the thinking that they were doing. So they were like, no, we definitely need a specialist here. So they started a protest. And they protested outside of government buildings. They protested outside of the hospital every Wednesday, I want to say. Yeah, because clinic day. So they protested outside every week for a couple of months. And they then got a meeting with our Minister for Health, who agreed to give us a sarcoma specialist. Now, again, this is 2016. This is before my time. So this would have been where Kelly and her husband Gino were hugely a part of this. So they would have organized these protests. They had a huge amount of media coverage for it. There was lots in the papers. There was stuff on the TV. And the Minister for Health then agreed to give us a sarcoma specialist, which took 4 years to get here.
Oh, wow.
So there was one medical oncologist treating this. Now, in fairness, he wasn't a sarcoma specialist, but it was one medical oncologist was treating all of the sarcoma patients. So he did have knowledge.
he was becoming a specialist.
Pretty much, yeah. And I actually think he might have done a fellowship over in the US. So he would have had knowledge anyway. So they did give us a post of sarcoma specialist, but it took four years to fill that post.
Was it because it was just hard to find someone, or just getting the commitment for them to make it a priority to fill it?
Both of those things. So we did have somebody coming over, and then she delayed, and there was a thing, and it took a year and a half. And then before she was supposed to start, she didn't start. So then we had to get a search, and we now have our sarcoma specialist. He started in 2021, January 2021.
Wow. That's amazing. Making your voice heard and advocating to be able to create change. And I think that is the perfect representation of what that actually means.
Them guys did amazing job. Other than that, we would have been like seen by maybe an oncologist who has never seen a sarcoma or who wouldn't have dealings with it. So at least I know I had my phone call from clinic yesterday from the advanced nurse practitioner. And she's like, okay, Carol, we're good. Clear scans. I know they've been checked by the oncologist who knows what he's doing. You know, like, it's very, you just feel so much better when you know it's somebody who knows what they're doing. And when we would have patients contact us, one of the first things I say to them is, has your case been seen by the MDT? Not necessarily are you being treated by the MDT, but has your case been seen by the MDT?
Since the WhatsApp group started that you got involved in, you guys have made tremendous amount of progress. So you got involved, what year did you get involved with Sarcoma Cancer Ireland?
So I think that original new WhatsApp group was probably tail end of 2019. So I was kind of involved from there. Again, I had a lot of time on my hands because I didn't have a job anymore. So Kev was delighted. It gave me something to do. So I wasn't giving him things to do instead. So he would be extremely supportive of my work with Sarcoma Cancer Ireland because it means less for him to do. So probably about 2019. And then ironically, COVID was actually really good for us because we were all across the country and then the likes of Zoom kicked in. So we were like, you know what, let's do it. Let's just do it. So we got onto Zoom. Actually, it was 2019 and we had started to form ideas of what we wanted. There was no information at all here. There was no support here. There was no peer support. There was no financial support. So that was something that we wanted to change. And it was more we wanted to change the if you are diagnosed, you have somewhere you can go to speak to somebody.
You want to build a community.
It was exactly that. It was the community that we wanted, because I think that's probably the best help that I had along the way was the community.
Right.
Right. Finding someone else that was going through exactly what you were going through, but also finding someplace that was a resource.
Yes.
Where you didn't feel alone and you could get accurate information and someone to help be a part of your journey that had also been a part of the journey, right?
That's exactly it.
Different.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Because like when I was Googling stuff, I was getting stuff about MD Anderson, Sloan Kettering, all the doctors there. And I was like, what about my doctors here? Mm-hmm. You know, who? Now I actually ended up bringing Sarcoma UK and they have a nurse line and they talked me through stuff. They answered questions for me and they were brilliant and they still are brilliant. So one of the first things we did when we decided we were doing this is we spoke to Roger Wilson.
Yes.
And Roger had all the time in the world for us and he walked us through what we would need to do because our laws would be very similar to the UK's laws and charity regulators would be very similar. Now, ironically, the UK's is actually less than ours. Ours would be much more stringent, but they would be very similar. You need to do similar steps to get to charity status and to be able to do stuff. So Roger was amazing, absolutely amazing. He talked us through everything and he was like, you need to do this, you need to do this. if you have any more questions, come back to me, himself and his wife, Sheila. They had, me and Kelly were on the phone for about 2.5 hours one day, again on Zoom. And they were our first major people to talk to. And they were like, we love this idea. Whatever we can do to help, we will help. So then they put us in touch, the nurses, Sam and Helen from Sarcoma UK, are fabulous, right? They're absolutely fabulous. And they answered all of our questions and they were like, I'm not sure about that, and put us through to the CEO, Richard. Mm-hmm. And again, we had a very long conversation with Richard and they were like, whatever you need, like paperwork wise, we have, ask us for it and then use it yourself. You know, obviously change it to what you need, but they were like, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. We have it all done. It's all for the same kind of stuff. So tell us what you want. Tell us what you need and we will help. And they did help. So like they played a huge part in us being where we are.
Yeah. Sarcoma UK is a great organization, as is Roger Wilson, who I sit on a lot of advisory boards and boards with Roger. And he has got an enormous amount of history and knowledge about sarcoma from all different angles, and just a real, real asset to the sarcoma community for sure. And I know just from following your group and following on social media and having met you and the group just a few years ago, but we see each other at different meetings and things. It's amazing to me to see how much awareness your group has gotten, how much awareness Sarcoma Cancer Ireland has gotten, how much of a community that you guys have already built. It's amazing that you've been able to do that work. And how did you do it?
So this year for our Sarcoma Awareness Month in July, so like, again, we're a really small country. Our population is like 5.5 million. And that's huge compared to what it was 10 years ago. So like we are really small and our social media following is like 7,500 on Facebook and like 1,500 on Instagram. Over this July, we did our awareness month. We hit like 1.4 million views over our social medias during July. So we were literally blown away by this. It was absolutely amazing. And I was stalking that social media going, oh my God, we're at like 955,000, nearly there. But like, again, because we're so small, this is huge. And the main aim for us is awareness that if you do have a little weird swelling, go get it checked. 90%, 99% chance it's not anything. But then on the off chance, it might be. Like we've had a couple of, say, physiotherapists contact us and say, I actually never really thought about this, but in future, if it's something that I'm not sure of, I'm going to request that they go for MRIs. So that in itself is amazing. We actually last year had somebody contact us and say, I saw one of those stories and I had a lump on my arm and I went and got it checked and was diagnosed with sarcoma. She's like, I wouldn't have got that checked probably for a long time until it was causing issues. She's like, but I was kind of going, I've seen, you know, there was a couple of different stories about arms and legs and stuff with lumps on. And she was like, I'm going to get it checked. And she was diagnosed and is doing really well.
That's so amazing.
It is absolutely brilliant. And if it changes two or three people that they look and go, okay, then the work we put in is definitely worth it. Like we actually did a GP kind of initiative last month as well. So we printed up flyers and it was signs and symptoms of sarcoma, what you should do, what steps they should follow, and referrals, the referral pathway to the sarcoma center. And we posted them to all GP practices across Ireland.
Yeah, that's a hugely important piece of awareness too. It's not just on the patient.
Yeah, so these were specifically for the GPs in the GP practice, because like my GP is brilliant. She is absolutely amazing and always has been. And she actually said to me one day, I have nightmares about you. And I was like, I love you. Harsh. And she said to me, you know, I actually genuinely have nightmares. She's like, if you hadn't have seen the consultant you saw, we could have had a very different outcome. And mm-hmm. like my GP practice is huge and I was their first sarcoma patient. Now I've been a patient there for 25 years. So I was the first patient they've seen in 25 years in that surgery. And it would wow. be in a very big part of Dublin that would be very built up and there's a lot of people there. And then somebody came after me in the surgery and they thought of me and went, right, we need to get this person MRI'd now. So it was like, because of my story, they went and did straight away with somebody else. So we're hoping that the GPs take a look at these and go, okay, put it in the back of your head that that's a possibility.
Right.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. That is something that SFA is working very hard on as well right now. We agree 100% that let's make them aware. Let's give them the resources they need in case they think they have a patient in front of them, rather than saying what we run into a lot is, oh, it's nothing, right? Oh, it's nothing. It's growing yeah. pains. It's not this. It's not that. And they don't want to refer for the test just to see if it is. What does it hurt? What does it hurt to refer for the test just to make sure?
Yeah.
So the fact that you're building that is absolutely going to have an impact. It's absolutely yeah. going to save people who are diagnosed with sarcoma that are going to get a quicker diagnosis that can right. absolutely improve their outcomes. So yeah, that's amazing that you're doing that. It's really inspiring. And I know that it's not easy to do because you all are a group of volunteers essentially working on this. Is that correct?
Yes, we're all volunteers. Yeah.
Yeah, a group of volunteers coming together and just saying, we're passionate about this and we're going to do all of this to be able to help others. And you guys have gained so much traction in such a short period of time. I mean, I truly am inspired by everything you've done and what you continue to do. It's amazing to watch what you're doing and how can we also use that in the US. And also I should mention, SFA a few months ago actually hired our first staff member in the UK.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, because we fund research globally. We funded research in Ireland.
I saw that actually. Yeah.
Yeah. For us, it's really important bringing together that global research.
100%.
Number one, like, to be able this to move forward.
This is definitely something I have seen in the sarcoma community worldwide from being at the conferences and speaking to people, is just how small the community is. Like, you don't really see big egos in it. They want to help. They want to be able to do the best for their patients. They all collaborate with each other. And I think that's absolutely brilliant. There isn't what we would call an old boys network in it. It's, I'm going to go to him and see, like, I met a surgeon over when we were at the SPAN conference in Washington. And I had been chatting to him during the lunch break and stuff. And then a patient here asked me, I'm at a stage where I need help. There's not really more options here in Ireland. And I was like, I know somebody who might be able to help you. I emailed him and he got an automatic out of office response. He was on vacation, but he emailed me back 15 mm-hmm. minutes later. And he was like, yeah, no problem talking to that patient, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I love that about this community because it's everybody wants the same thing and it's everybody is working towards that same goal of better outcomes, the research that's happening. And like, our organization is really focused on patient support. So like, for supporting the actual patient, the patient's families as well. So we have like support groups, we do counseling, we have financial support. We would like to, in the future, if we have the funding for it, go and fund research as well for education and advocacy parts of it. So that's hopeful for the future. But right now, our focus is on the basically advocacy for the patients and getting the education out there. So like, the GP project was done alongside the Irish Sarcoma Group. So it was done in conjunction with our doctors and our clinical nurse specialists. And it was all signed off by our clinical team, the oncologist and the radiologist. So we work alongside those guys really well. And it's just a lovely community. And it's not one that I ever wanted to be part of, but I, now that I am, I'm kind of glad that I am part of it. Yeah. Obviously not the sickness part.
Yeah, not the way you want to be interviewed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, we would have regular meetings with our advanced nurse practitioner for the MDT. And if we have questions for our radiologist, like, realistically, I would send them a tweet or message on X, or I'd email him and say, I have this blah, blah, blah. You know, somebody asked me, can you help me? And he'd be like, yeah, no problem. And we'll answer straight away. And that is very different to how we began, because we were fighting the system back in 2016, 2017. So our medical team, our Irish sarcoma group, literally couldn't be any more supportive of us. So, like, we've done a complete turnabout on that, because we were fighting it because we needed what we needed. And right. you had to be heard. And now it's like, we are all, it's the same thing, it's the community, it's, we are all looking for the same thing, best outcomes for the patient, how we can help the patient, how we can make sure the patient journey is as smooth and as easy as it could possibly be. Like, we might have a patient come to us and ask a question, and I would have absolutely no problem going to our consultant radiologist and asking him a question, and he will come back to me and he will answer, and I will go back to, or I will say, you need to speak to this patient, there's their details, and he'll do that because he wants what we want. And like, we would have regular catch-ups with people that, if there's any queries that we have or they have. And it's really good because it is the sharing of information, and it is the sharing of, I suppose, needing to help people.
No, you're right. It is the needing to help people. We get requests like that all the time, of reaching out or people coming to us and asking us questions. And that's why those relationships are so important, because if there is a question, you can go out and ask, or if there's a need to get somebody in to see a doctor, you can make that happen, or you can make those important connections that need to be made. And that is the one thing I will agree with you that I found very interesting about the sarcoma community, is these medical professionals will respond.
Yes, it's amazing.
They absolutely will respond. There's never a time that we have sent a message to anyone and they have not responded, and not responded in, let me see how I can help you, right? I mean, it's right. Always, how can we help? And that's an amazing experience that we're, you know, as you said, unlucky to be a part of the community in a way.
Yeah.
But lucky if it's the community you have to be a part of, then this is a great community to be a part of.
That's exactly it. It's a really good one to be part of if you have to be part of one.
Yeah. They say worst club, best members.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
I'll ask you our last two questions. So first one, if you could give advice to our listeners, what's like your one piece of advice you would share or message?
So probably don't Google it, but you're going to Google it. So if you are going to Google it, go to the sarcoma group in your country and they will show you where to Google it. You know, show you the actual proper websites with the accurate information, rather than you going down a rabbit hole and driving yourself absolutely insane.
Well, that leads me into my next final question really, really well. But if someone wanted to connect with you or Sarcoma Cancer Ireland, how can they do that?
On our social media. So we're on like everything, I think, X, again, not Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, I think probably LinkedIn. That's Rebecca's job. That's not mine. And it's Sarcoma Cancer Ireland. So we're fairly easy to find, or they can email into support@sarcoma.ie.
Amazing. Great. We'll make sure to link that in the show notes too, so it will be there. But Carol, thanks so much for being our first international guest, for joining us today and sharing your story and giving us your time. It was lovely to chat with you. And I've heard your story before, but I mean, every time I learn something new from you. So it's such a gift. But thank you for sharing and for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
SFA created Sarcoma Stories to highlight the individual stories of sarcoma patients, survivors, and care partners, to amplify the many stories we consistently hear and bring together the broad range of lived experiences of sarcoma patients. SFA has also created a Sarcoma Journey Survey. This survey is vitally important as we need to collect data for sarcoma subtypes to help advance research and effective treatments and put data to the stories we consistently hear. To learn more about this survey and to take the survey yourself, please head to the show notes and you'll find the survey link.